Chapter 44. The morning of the wedding arrived. Cinder was a wreck of frazzled thoughts and skittish nerves, but at the center of it was a strange sense of calm. Before the sun set again, she would know the outcome of all their planning and preparations. Either they would succeed today, or they would all become prisoners of Queen Lavanna. Or they'd be dead. She tried not to think of that as she showered and dressed and ate a meager breakfast of stale crackers and almond butter. It was all her churning stomach could handle. The sun had just showed itself over the frosted Siberian tundra when they piled into the remaining pod ship, 7 people crammed into a space meant for 5, to embark on the 40-minute low-elevation flight to New Beijing. No one complained. The Rampion was far too large to hide. At least the pod ship would be able to blend in with all the other pod ships in a city suddenly swarming with foreign spacecraft. The ride was torturously and mostly silent, punctuated only by Aiko's and Thorne's occasional chatter. Cinder spent the ride switching between news feeds covering the royal wedding and the ongoing coverage of the rebellion in Farafra. The townspeople had given up their control of the military personnel as soon as reinforcements arrived. Rather than attempt to arrest and transport hundreds of civilians, the Commonwealth military, with permission from the African government, put the entire city into armed lockdown until they could all be thoroughly questioned and charged. The citizens were being treated as traitors to the Earthen Union for helping Lynn Cinder, Dimitri Erland, and Carswell Thorne. Although the news kept reporting that the government was willing to be lenient with anyone who came forward with information about the fugitives and their ship. So far, not one of the citizens of Farafra seemed to be cooperating. Cinder wondered if the lunar townspeople were being treated the same as the Earthens, or if they were just waiting to be sent back to Luna for their real trial. To date, no journalist had mentioned that many of the rebels were lunar. Cinder suspected the government was trying to keep that little fact quiet, to avoid mass panic in neighboring towns, or even all over the world, which would surely come once Earthens realized how easy it was for lunars to blend in with them. Cinder could still remember when she'd believed there weren't any lunars on Earth, and how horrified she'd been when Dr. Erland had told her she was wrong. Her reaction seemed ridiculously naive now. As New Beijing came into view, Cinder sent the news feeds away. The buildings at the city's center were grand and imposing, like willowy sculptures of chrome and glass reaching toward the sky. Cinder was caught off guard by a sudden ache that hit her. Homesickness. A homesickness she'd been too busy to recognize until that moment. The palace stood regally beneath the morning sun, high on its watchful cliff, but they veered away from it. Jason followed Cinder's direction toward downtown, eventually mixing with clusters of hovers and, she was glad to see, multiple pod ships as well. Cinder's stop was first, 2 blocks away from the Phoenix Tower apartments. She took in a deep breath as she disembarked. Though autumn would be sweeping in fast over the next few weeks, New Beijing was still in summer's grip, and the day was starting off cloudless and warm. The temperature was just a click above comfortable, but not stifling with humidity as it had been the last time Cinder was in the city. "If you don't see me at the checkpoint in 10 minutes," she said, "loop the block a few times and come back." Jason nodded without looking at her.
"If you get the chance," said Aiko, "give Audrey a big kick in the rump for me, with the metal foot."
Cinder laughed, though the sound was awkward. Then they were gone, leaving her alone on a street she'd walked 1,000 times. She'd already called up her glamour, but it was difficult to focus, so she kept her head down anyway as she made her way to the apartments she had once called home. It was strange to be alone, after weeks of being surrounded by friends and allies, but she was glad that no one else was joining her for this stage of the plan. It seemed weirdly important to distance herself from the girl she'd been when she lived in this apartment, and the idea of her new friends meeting her ex-stepfamily made her cringe. Her shirt was already sticking to her back as she approached the apartment's main entrance. She waited until another resident came through, unlocking the doors with their embedded ID chip and slipped in behind them. A familiar dread settled over her as she crossed the small lobby, a feeling that had once seemed normal, but this time, she also felt a sense of purpose as she entered the elevator. She was no longer the unwanted cyborg orphan who did as she was told and skittered off to her basement workroom to avoid Audrey's bitter glares. She was free. She was in control. She didn't belong to Audrey anymore. For perhaps the first time, she stepped out of the elevator with her head high. The hallway was empty except for a mangy gray cat cleaning himself. Cinder came to apartment 1820, squared her shoulders, and knocked. Footsteps padded on the other side of the door, and she focused on her glamour. Cinder had chosen to take on the appearance of one of the officials she'd seen standing behind Kai at the last press conference. Middle-aged, slightly pudgy, with gray-flecked black hair and a too-small-for-her-face nose. She mimicked her exactly, down to the blue-gray business suit and sensible tanned shoes. The door opened and a cloud of stale, hot air swept into the hallway. Audrey stood before her, tying a belt around her silk bathrobe. She almost always wore her bathrobe when she was at home, but this was not the same one Cinder was familiar with. Her hair was pulled back, and she wasn't yet wearing any makeup. There was a fine sheen of sweat on her face. Cinder expected her body to recoil under her stepmother's inspection, but it didn't. Rather, as she looked at Audrey, she felt only a detached coldness. This was just a woman with an invitation to the royal wedding. This was just another task to cross off the list. "Yes," said Audrey, skeptical gaze swooping over her. Cinder, the palace official, bowed. "Good morning. Is Lynn Audrey Gere at home?"
"I am Lynn Audrey."
"A pleasure. I apologize for disturbing you at such an early hour," said Cinder, launching into her practice speech. "I am a member of the Royal Wedding Planning Committee, and I understand you were promised 2 invitations to the nuptials between His Imperial Majesty, Emperor Kaito, and Her Lunar Majesty, Queen Lavanna. As you are one of our distinguished civilian guests, I am honored to personally deliver your invitations for tonight's ceremony." She held out 2 pieces of paper. In reality, disposable napkin scraps. But to Audrey's eye, 2 finely crafted, hand-pressed paper envelopes. At least, she hoped that's what Audrey was seeing. The closest Cinder had yet to come to changing the perception of an inanimate object was her own prosthetic hand, and she wasn't sure if that counted. Audrey frowned at the napkins, but it quickly turned into a patient smile, no doubt because she now believed she was talking to someone from the palace.
"There must be some mistake," she said. "We received our invitations last week."
Cinder feigned surprise and withdrew the napkins.
"How peculiar. Would you mind if I took a look at those invitations so I can make sure some mishap hasn't occurred?"
Audrey's grin tightened, but she stepped aside and ushered Cinder into the apartment.
"Of course. Please come in. Can I offer you some tea?"
"Thank you, no. We'll just clear up this confusion, and I won't intrude any more on your time."
She followed Audrey into the living room.
"I must apologize for the heat," said Audrey, grabbing a fan off a small side table and flicking it before her face. "The air has been broken for a week now, and the maintenance here is completely incompetent. I used to have a servant to assist with these things, a cyborg ward my husband took in, but... well, it doesn't matter now. Good riddance."
Cinder bristled. "Servant?" But she ignored the comment as her gaze traveled over the room. It hadn't changed much, with the exception of the items displayed on the mantle of the holographic fireplace. Belongings that had held such prominent position before. Lynn Garen's award plaques and alternating digital photos of Pearl and Peony had been crammed together at the mantle's far edge. Now, at its center, stood a beautiful porcelain jar, painted with pink and white peonies, and set atop a carved mahogany base. Cinder sucked in a breath.
Not a jar. An urn. A cremation urn. Her mouth went dry. She heard Audrey padding across the living room, but her focus was pinned to that urn. And what? Who would be inside it? Of their own accord, her feet began to move toward the mantle and Peony's remains. Her funeral had come and gone, and Cinder had not been there. Audrey and Pearl had wept, had no doubt invited every person from Peony's classes, every person from this apartment building, every distant relative who had barely known her, who had probably griped about having to send the expected sympathy card and flowers. But Cinder hadn't been there. "My daughter," said Audrey. Cinder gasped and pulled away. She hadn't realized that her fingers were brushing against a painted flower until Audrey had spoken. "Gone only recently of letimosis," Audrey continued, as if Cinder had asked. "She was only 13. There was a sadness in her voice. True sadness. It was perhaps the one thing they had ever had in common. "I'm sorry," Cinder whispered, grateful that in her distraction some instinct had maintained her glamour. She forced herself to focus before her eyes started trying to make tears. They would fail, she was incapable of crying. But the effort sometimes gave her a headache that wouldn't go away for hours, and now was not the time for mourning. She had a wedding to stop.
"Do you have children?" Audrey asked.
No, I don't," said Cinder, having no idea if the palace official she was impersonating did or not.
"I have one other daughter, 17 years old. It was not very long ago that all I could think of was finding her a nice, wealthy husband. Daughters are expensive, you know, and a mother wants to give them everything. But now, I can't stand the thought of her leaving me too." She sighed and tore her gaze away from the urn.
"But listen to me, carrying on, when you must have so many other places to be today. Here are the invitations we received."
Cinder took them carefully, glad to change the subject. Now that she was seeing a real invitation up close, she changed the glamour she'd made up for the napkins. The paper was a little stiffer, slightly more ivory with gold embossed letters and a flourishing script on one side and traditional second-era kanji on the other.
"Interesting," said Cinder, opening the top invitation. She faked a laugh, hoping it didn't sound as painful as it was.
"Ah-ha-ha! These are the invitations for Lin Zheng and his wife. Your addresses must have gotten switched in our database. How silly!"
Audrey cocked her head.
"Are you sure? When they arrived, I was certain. See for yourself."
Cinder angled the paper so Audrey could see what wasn't there. What Cinder told her to see. What Cinder told her to believe.
"Goodness, so it is," said Audrey.
Cinder handed Audrey the napkins and watched as her stepmother handled them as though they were the most precious items in the world.
"Well then," she said, her voice barely warbling, "I'll see myself out. I hope you'll enjoy the ceremony."
Audrey dropped the napkins into her robe's pocket.
"Thank you for taking the time to deliver these yourself. His Imperial Majesty certainly is a gracious host."
"We are lucky to have him," Cinder meandered into the hallway. As her hand landed on the door, she realized with a jolt that this could be the last time she ever saw her stepmother.
The very last time, if she could dare to hope.
She attempted to smother the temptation that roiled inside her at the thought. But she still found herself turning back to face Audrey.
"I have nothing to say. I have nothing to say to you." But all the common sense in the world could not convince her of those words.
"I don't mean to pry," she started again, clearing her throat. "But you mentioned a cyborg before. You wouldn't happen to be the guardian of Lin Cinder?"
Audrey's kindness fell away. "I was, unfortunately. Thank the stars that's all behind us now."
Against all her reasoning, Cinder stepped back into the apartment, blocking the doorway.
"But she grew up here. Didn't you ever feel that she could have been a part of your family? Didn't you ever think of her as a daughter?
Audrey huffed, fanning herself again. You didn't know the girl. Always ungrateful. Always thinking she was so much better than us because of her additions. Cyborgs are like that, you know. So self-important. It was awful for us living with her. A cyborg and a lunar? Although we didn't know it until her mortifying spectacle at the ball. She tightened her belt. And now she's soiled our family name. I have to ask that you not judge us by her. I did all I could to help the girl, but she was unredeemable from the start. Cinder's fingers twitched, a familiar taste of rebellion. She ached to toss off her glamour, to yell and scream, to force Audrey to see her, the real her, just once. Not the ungrateful, self-important little girl that Audrey thought she was, but the orphan who had always just wanted a family, who had only wanted to belong somewhere. But even as she thought this, a darker yearning climbed up her spine. She wanted Audrey to be sorry for how she treated Cinder like a piece of property, for how she had taken Cinder's prosthetic foot and forced her to hobble around like a broken doll, for how she had taunted Cinder again and again for her inability to cry, her inability to love, her inability to ever be human. She found herself reaching out with her mind, detecting the waves of bioelectricity that shimmered off the surface of Audrey's skin. Before she could rein in the anger that roiled through her, Cinder pressed every ounce of guilt and remorse and shame into her stepmother's thick skull, twisting her emotions so rashly that Audrey gasped and stumbled, her side slamming into the wall. "But didn't you ever wonder how hard it must have been?" Cinder said through her teeth. A headache was coming on fast, throbbing against her dry eyes. "Didn't you ever feel guilty over the way she was treated? Didn't you ever think that maybe you could have loved her if only you'd taken the time to talk to her, to understand her?" Audrey groaned and pressed one hand to her stomach, like the years of guilt had been eating away at her, slowly making her sick. Cinder grimaced and began to ease up on the attack of emotions. When Audrey met her gaze again, there were tears watering her eyes. Her breath was ragged. "Sometimes," Audrey said, her tone weak. "Sometimes I do think that maybe she was misunderstood. She was so young when we adopted her. She must have been afraid. And my darling Peony always seemed so fond of her. And sometimes I think if things had been different, with Garen and our finances, perhaps she could have belonged here. You understand? If only she had been normal." The last word struck Cinder between her ribs, and she flinched, releasing the small strands of guilt. Audrey shuddered, swiping her robe's sleeve across her eyes. It made no difference. Audrey could be filled with all the guilt in the world, but in her own mind, the blame would always be with Cinder, because Cinder couldn't have just been normal.
I'm so sorry, said Audrey, pinching the bridge of her nose. She'd gone pale. The tears were gone. "I don't know what came over me. Ever since I lost my daughter, sometimes my mind just..." She turned her focus back up to Cinder. "Please don't misunderstand me. Lynn Cinder, she's a lying, manipulative girl. I hope they catch her. I would do anything to make sure she can't ruin anyone else the way she ruined me and my family." Cinder nodded. "I understand, Lin Zhe," she whispered. "I completely understand." Curling her fingers around the invitations she'd come for, Cinder ducked back out of the apartment. The headache was splitting against her skull now, making it hard to focus on anything other than putting each foot in front of the other. She managed to maintain a flimsy grip on the glamour, not sure if Audrey was still watching her, until she stepped into the elevator at the end of the corridor. She froze. On the back wall of the elevator was a mirror. She stared back at her own reflection as the doors slipped shut behind her. Her heart started to pound. Thankfully, no one else was in the elevator to witness her, because she lost her hold on the glamour immediately, gaping into her own brown eyes and, for the first time, felt horrified of who she saw in that reflection. Because what she'd done to Audrey twisting her emotions against her, forcing her to feel guilt and shame for no other reason than Cinder's own terrible curiosity, her own burning desire for retaliation? It was something Lavanna would have done. Chapter 45. Aiko blew kisses and waved, a fluttery five-fingered wave, as the pod ship coasted off the road and merged with the morning traffic. It was not a far walk to the warehouse, but she could feel her internal processor humming with excitement the whole way. By her calculation, she would be arriving at the warehouse by 07:25. The delivery hour, filled with the palace's order of 60 escorts, was set to depart from the warehouse at 07:32. Half of the escorts would be dropped off at the catering office by 07:58. The rest would be delivered to the florist at 08:43, to be taken to the palace along with the human staff. Aiko expected that she would be inside the palace by no later than 09:50. The industrial district was mostly deserted. Much of the city, and perhaps the whole world, had taken this as a holiday in order to watch the royal wedding. No one was around to notice Aiko as she strutted down the alley toward the warehouse or hopped blithely over the chain-link fence into the yard where five delivery ships were backed up to the warehouse loading docks. She was dressed simply in black slacks and a white blouse. She was still a little disappointed that she couldn't wear a fancy ball gown, but she felt stunning in her own way. She couldn't wait for Emperor Kai to see her. The thought put an extra bounce in her step as she rounded the front of the first ship and darted up the stairs into the loading dock. The sight before her made her pause and almost crash face first into her perfectly shaped nose. The warehouse was filled with escort droids, mostly girls of all different skin tones and hair colors. Most were unclothed, sitting on the ground with their arms wrapped compactly around their knees and their heads tucked down. There were well over 200 androids lined up in neat rows. Some had packing tape and protective tissue wrapped around their limbs to protect them during shipping. Some had been loaded onto pallets and settled onto plastic crates. Packing foam and cardboard littered the floor around them. On the wall to Aiko's left, there were three stories of metal shelving filled with the packing crates, all labeled with the escort's makes and models and special features.
"Is this all of them?" said a man.
Aiko ducked behind the wall of the warehouse before inching forward and peering around the door jamb. She spotted 60 androids, 45 female and 15 male, all standing in neat rows. They were all dressed in identical black pants and blush-toned silk tops, simple mandarin-collared dress shirts for the men, and elegant wraps for the women that tied at the waists and draped kimono style on their arms. Each girl had her hair pulled into a tight bun with an orchid tucked into the side.
"Checking off the order now,"
said a woman who was marching between the rows and making notations on a port screen.
"The order form specified a petite model of make 618, not the medium."
"I know, but our last petite got shipped out last week. I cleared the change with the palace on Thursday."
The woman tapped something into the port. 59, 60.
"That's all of them."
"Great, let's load them up. Can't let them be late for their royal mission."
The man pulled up the massive rolling door, opening the bay to one of the delivery ships, as the woman began making her way through the androids again, opening a panel in each of their necks, their postures softened.
"Enter single file," ordered the man. "Squeeze in tight. It'll be a close fit."
The androids marched one by one into the ship. There was no way Aiko could get all the way over there without being noticed, and her different clothes would make it clear that she didn't belong. The idea that they could mistake her for a rogue android and send her out for reprogramming made her wiring quiver. Keeping low, she slinked along the wall, away from the two employees, and ducked beneath the first tower of industrial shelving. Hidden behind the crates, she made her way toward the rows of escort droids that were waiting to be packaged up. Reaching the last row, she crouched down behind an android and felt for the latch on her neck. Aiko glanced up to see that half of the rental escort droids had already settled into the ship.
Humming to herself, she turned the android on. The processor whirred, and her head raised. This one had white blonde hair tipped with fluorescent green that hung to her waist. Aiko brushed her hair off her shoulder and whispered,
"I command you to stand up, scream, and run for the exit."
The girl launched to her feet almost before Aiko finished speaking. She started to scream, a spine-chilling, ear-bleeding sound. Aiko threw herself to the ground behind the row of still-seated and oblivious androids and adjusted the volume on her audio processor. But it was too late. The android had already stopped screaming and was now running full speed for the exit, knocking her statue-like brethren over as she passed. Aiko heard the two employees' cries of shock and then their footsteps pounding as they chased after the android. As soon as they jumped down to the loading yard, Aiko bounced up and scurried through the rows of androids. The rental escort said nothing, only blinked at her lazily as she pushed her way into their midst.
Sorry, don't mind me, coming through. Oh, why, hello there.
This to a particularly handsome Kai lookalike droid, which had no more reaction than any of the others.
Or not, she muttered, brushing past him. Pardon me. A little space, please.
By the time the two workers had returned, winded and ranting about faulty personality chips and those imbeciles up in programming, Aiko had settled comfortably in the back of the ship, squeezed between two of her distant cousins and finding it difficult not to grin like a lunatic. As it turned out, being human was every bit as much fun as she'd always thought it would be. It was easy to grasp why the government of 126 years ago had chosen this spot for the royal family's safe house. It was less than 10 miles from the city of New Beijing, but they were separated by such jagged cliffs that it seemed as though they had entered another country entirely. The house itself was built in a valley carved out with overgrown rice terraces, though Cinder doubted any rice had been cultivated there in generations, giving the house a sense of abandonment. Jason settled the pod ship beside the farmhouse, and they stepped out onto a patch of land still soggy from heavy summer rains. The world was silent around them, and the air perfumed with fall grasses and wildflowers.
"I hope the girl was right," said Jason, moving toward the house.
Despite its boarded-up windows, it appeared well-maintained. Cinder suspected that a crew was responsible for checking on it a couple of times a year, to patch roof tiles and ensure that the power generation wasn't malfunctioning, so that if a catastrophe ever did occur, it would still be a safe place for the Emperor to retire to. It was probably monitored, too, but she hoped that today, of all days, the country's security division would have their hands full elsewhere.
"One way to find out," she said, walking around the side of the house where iron doors rested over a cellar entryway.
If Cress was right, these doors didn't lead to a dank storage cellar at all, but to a tunnel that would run beneath the cliffs and lead them straight into the palace sublevels. Cinder pried open the doors and whipped her built-in flashlight around the stairs. The light caught on cobwebs and concrete and an old-fashioned switch that would light up the tunnel beneath, at least for a little distance.
"This seems to be it," she said, glancing back at the group.
Thorn, blindfolded, was resting his elbow on a scowling Dr. Erland.
"It was going to be a long walk."
"All right," she said. "Jason, come back with the Rampion and circle the city until you get my comm."
"I know."
"And keep an eye out for anything suspicious. If you detect anything at all, keep flying and wait for us to contact you again."
"I know."
"If everything goes as planned, we'll be at the palace landing pad by 1800, but if something goes wrong, we might have to come back here, or through one of the escape tunnels to the other safe—"
"Cinder," said Thorn,
"he knows." She glared at him and wanted to argue, but going over their escape plan one more time wasn't going to do anything but remind her of all the things that could go wrong. Jason did know. They'd discussed the matter into the ground, and everyone was all too aware of how easily this plan could fall apart without him. Without any of them. "Fine. Let's go."
Chapter 46. Cress studied herself in the full-length dressing room mirror and almost began to cry. She had somehow, some way, become a character in an opera. Her skin had sloughed off the last of the sunburn, leaving the tiniest kiss of sun on her complexion. Aiko had cropped her hair so that it framed her face in pretty golden waves, and though they'd had no makeup aboard the ship, Aiko had also taught her to pinch her cheeks and nibble on her lips until they flushed a nice pinkish color. She was, against her better judgment, beginning to warm to Aiko. At least she wasn't as bad as that Darla had been. And though Cress herself had been the one to place the rush purchase at the designer boutique, using a hacked financial account, she hadn't entirely believed this was at all happening before this moment. She was going to a royal wedding, in a gown of raw silk and chiffon, dyed deep royal blue to match her eyes, Aiko's suggestion. The bodice was snug and the skirt so full she wasn't entirely sure she could walk without tripping. The shoes were simple, form-fitting flats. Though she and Aiko had discussed an array of fancy heels at length, Cinder had reminded them that Cress may have to run for her life at some point during the day's events, and practicality had won out.
"Bristol May, what do you think?"
asked the attendant as she finished with the last button on Cress's back.
"It's perfect, thank you." The girl preened. "We are thrilled that you chose us for your royal wedding debut. We could not be more honored."
She scooped Cress's hair away from her ears.
"Do you have your jewelry with you to see how it looks all put together?"
Cress tugged awkwardly at her earlobe.
"Oh, no, that's all right. I have to pick it up on the way to the palace."
Though a flicker of confusion crossed the girl's face, she merely bowed her head and shuffled out of the dressing room.
"Are you ready for your husband to see you?"
Cress flinched.
"I suppose."
She followed the attendant out of the dressing room and into a luxuriously furnished sitting area, where she spotted her new husband. Wolf was scowling at a mirror and trying to pat down his unkempt hair. He wore an impeccably fitted tuxedo with a classic white bow tie and pressed lapels. He caught Cress's eye in the reflection, and she couldn't help but stand a little straighter. But though his gaze skimmed over her, he had no reaction whatsoever. Deflated, Cress clasped her hands.
"You look great, sweetheart."
He did, in fact, look like a romance hero, all muscles and edges and chiseled bone structure. He also looked miserable. Suddenly nervous, Cress gave a little twirl, displaying her full regalia. Wolf only gave her a crisp nod.
"The hover is waiting."
She let her hands drop to her sides, resigned to the fact that Wolf would dress for his role, but he would not play it.
"Right. You have the invitations?"
He patted his breast pocket. "Let's get this over with." In the delivery ship, traveling from the warehouse to the caterer, Aiko had found it all too easy to command another android to switch clothes so that she could fit in with the rest of them in their staff uniforms. As long as no one was too put off by her blue hair braids, which had now been pulled into a neat bun. She had departed the ship with the first group of rental androids at the catering office, so that when her body double was later discovered wearing the wrong clothes at the florist, Aiko would be long gone. And who would ever suspect her? She was just another brainless, obedient android. But that was the hard part. Standing in perfect unison with the others, blinking precisely 10 times a minute, keeping quiet while the human catering staff chatted excitedly about maybe seeing the Emperor himself and ruminated over how terrifying it would be if Queen Levana wasn't pleased with the food, Aiko was forced to bite her tongue, allowing her programmed instincts, the instincts she'd spent her life trying to keep buried while she learned about humor and sarcasm and affection, to keep her expressionless. From there, they had been herded into a large hover.
Though it wasn't a far distance, the trip was made longer as the hover rounded to the back of the palace, near the research and laboratory facilities and, of course, the staff entrance. Aiko sensed the chatter of the catering staff grow more nervous as the hover began to slow. She heard some gates being opened, and then the hover came to a gradual stop, and the staff began to file into a commercial loading dock. It was not the fancy entryway that Aiko had always envisioned entering the palace through, but she tried not to let her disappointment show as she fell into line behind her stiff cohorts. Two women were standing by the delivery entrance. One, wearing a jewel-toned sari, was notating something on her port screen, while the other scanned ID chips, ensuring that the staff had been pre-approved to work at this crucial event. When she'd finished with the humans, she ordered the escort droids into two single-file lines. Aiko slipped into the back as they were ushered inside. They were marched through the drab service halls, their shoes clicking in perfect synchronization. Aiko kept careful track of their progress, counting doors and comparing it with the blueprint that had been downloaded to her memory. The kitchen was precisely where she expected it, and even more massive in person than it had appeared on screen, with 8 industrial-size ovens, countless burners, and 3 counters that ran the length of the room where dozens of chefs were chopping, kneading, whisking, and measuring as they prepared to feed 1,200 of the galaxy's most honored guests. The woman in the sari pulled a man in a chef's coat aside. "The androids!" she yelled over the din, gesturing to Aiko and the others. "Where do you want them?" He scanned the line, his attention briefly snagging on Aiko's blue hair. Evidently, he determined that it wasn't in his job description to care, and he let his gaze slide past her.
"Leave them there for now. We'll send them out with the regular staff during the first course. All they have to do is carry a tray and smile. Think they can handle it?"
"We've been ensured that their programming is immaculate. It would be best if they could focus on our lunar guests. I want them alert in case anything untoward happens."
He shrugged. "No one on my staff wants anything to do with the lunars."
The man returned to his work, organizing gold trays at different workstations, and the woman left without another look at the androids. Aiko stood very, very still, and she was very, very well behaved. And she waited. And waited. And tried to imagine what was happening with Cinder and Cress and the others. None of the kitchen staff paid them any attention other than to shoot them the occasional glare for taking up too much space in the overcrowded kitchens. Aiko waited until she was confident no one was looking before she inched her hand behind the escort beside her. The android didn't even twitch as Aiko sought out the latch on her neck, opened it, and ran her fingers over the control panel. She pushed up a switch.
"Now accepting input commands," said the android, in a voice that was not quite human, not quite robot.
Aiko dropped her hand to the side and scanned the nearby chefs. The kitchen was too loud. No one had heard.
"Follow me."
Then, when she was again sure no one was watching, she ducked into the nearest corridor. The android followed like a trained pet. Aiko took them down 2 hallways, listening for voices or footsteps, but finding these lesser-used areas abandoned. As expected, all available staff was preparing for the ceremony and the reception, no doubt measuring the distance between plates and soup spoons at that very moment. When they reached a maintenance closet, Aiko ushered the escort droid inside.
"I want you to know that I hold nothing against you," she said by way of introduction. "I understand that it isn't your fault your programmer had so little imagination."
The escort droid held her gaze with empty eyes.
"In another life, we could have been sisters, and I feel it's important to acknowledge that."
A blank stare. A blink every 6 seconds.
"But as it stands, I'm a part of an important mission right now, and I cannot be swayed from my goal by my sympathy for androids who are less advanced than myself."
"Nothing."
"All right, then," Aiko held out her hands. "I need your clothes."
Chapter 47. Cress dug her fingers into the hover's seat, leaning into the window until her breath fogged against the glass. She couldn't open her eyes wide enough, not when there was so much to see, not when she could barely take it all in. The city of New Beijing was endless. To the east, a cluster of skyscrapers rose up out of the earth, silver and glass and sparkling orange under the late afternoon sun. Beyond the city center were warehouses and arenas, parks and suburbs, rolling on and on. Cress was glad for the distraction of all the new sights, the buildings, the people. Otherwise, she thought she would be sick. She gasped as the palace came into view atop its cliff, recognizing it from countless pictures and vids. Still, it was so different in real life. Even more magnificent and imposing. She splayed her fingers on the window, framing it in her vision. She could make out a line of vehicles and a mass of people outside the gates, winding down the cliffside and into the city below. Wolf also had his fierce eyes focused on the approaching palace, but she could sense no amount of awe from him, only impatience. His knee wouldn't stop bouncing, and his fingers kept flexing and tightening. Watching him was making her nervous. He'd been so subdued back at the Rampion, so impossibly motionless. She wondered if this burst of energy was the first sign that the bomb inside him had started to tick. Or maybe he was just anxious, like she was. Maybe he was tracing over their plan in his mind. Or maybe he was thinking about that girl, Scarlet. Cress was sad that she hadn't met her. It was as if the crew of the Rampion were missing a vital piece, and Cress didn't understand how she fit. She tried to think of the things she knew about Scarlet Benoit. She'd researched her a little when Cinder and Thorn had landed the ship on her grandmother's farm, but not very much. At the time, she'd had no idea that Scarlet had joined them. And Cress had only spoken with her once, when the whole crew had contacted her and asked for her help. She'd seemed nice enough, but Cress had been so focused on Thorn, she could hardly remember anything other than curly red hair. Fidgeting with the straps of her dress, she glanced at Wolf again, catching him in an attempt to loosen his bow tie. "Can I ask you a question?" His eyes swept over her.
"It's not about hacking security systems, is it?"
She blinked. "Of course not."
"Then fine."
She smothered her skirt around her knees. "This Scarlet. You're in love with her, aren't you?" He froze, becoming stone still. As the hover climbed the hill to the palace, his shoulders sank, and he returned his gaze to the window.
"She's my alpha,"
he murmured, with a haunting sadness in his voice. "Alpha." Cress leaned forward, propping her elbows on her knees. "Like the star?"
"What star?"
She stiffened, instantly embarrassed, and scooted back from him again.
In a constellation, the brightest star is called the Alpha. I thought maybe you meant that she's, like, your brightest star."
Looking away, she knotted her hands in her lap, aware that she was blushing furiously now, and this beast of a man was about to realize what an over-romantic sap she was. But instead of sneering or laughing, Wolf sighed.
"Yes,"
he said, his gaze climbing up to the full moon that had emerged over the city.
"Exactly like that."
With a quick twist to her heart, Cress's fear of him began to subside. She'd been right back at the boutique. He was like the hero of a romance story, and he was trying to rescue his beloved, his alpha. Cress had to bite the inside of her cheek to keep her imagination from skittering away with her. This wasn't some silly story. Scarlet Benoit was a prisoner on Luna. It was very likely that she was already dead. It was a thought that settled heavy in Cress's gut as the hover pulled in front of the palace gates. A greeter opened the door, and thousands of voices crowded in around them. With a shudder,
Cress gave the greeter her hand as she'd seen girls do on the net dramas. Her heel hit the tiled drive, and she was suddenly surrounded. Crowds of journalists and onlookers, both peaceful and angry, flocked around the courtyard, snapping photos, calling out questions, holding up signs that urged the emperor not to go through with this. Cress ducked her head, wanting to crawl back into the hover and hide from the piercing lights and throbbing chatter. The world began to spin. Oh, Spades. She was going to faint.
Miss, are you well?
Her throat went dry. Blood rushed through her ears and she was drowning, suffocating. Then a firm grip was on her elbow, drawing her away from the courtier. She stumbled, but Wolf put his iron-solid arm around her waist and squeezed her against him, forcing her to match his strides. Beside him, she felt as small and frail as a bird. But there was also a sense of protection. She focused on that, and within moments, a comforting dream slipped around her. She was a famous net drama actress making a big debut. And Wolf was her bodyguard. He wouldn't let anything happen to her. She simply had to hold her head high and be brave and be graceful and be confident. Her fine ball gown became a costume. The media became her adoring fans. Her spine straightened, millimeter by trembling millimeter, as the tingling darkness began to recede from her vision.
"All right," Wolf murmured. "I am a famous actress," she whispered back.
She dared not look up at him, afraid it would ruin the spell her imagination had cast. After a moment, his grip loosened. The noise of the crowd behind them faded away, replaced with the calm serenity of bubbling streams and the whisper of bamboo in the palace gardens. Cress stared straight ahead at the looming entrance, flanked by crimson pergolas. Two more courtiers waited at the top of the steps. Wolf produced the two embossed invitations. Cress was perfectly still as the scanner light flickered over the tiny chip that was embedded in the paper. She and Wolf wouldn't have fit the roles of Lynn Audrey and her daughter, but it had been child's play to change the ID profiles coded on each chip. According to the port screen, Wolf was now Mr. Samhain Bristol, Parliament Representative from Toronto, East Canada Province, UK, and she was his young wife. The actual Mr. Bristol was, to Cress's knowledge, still safe at home and unaware that he had a body double negating the political point he was trying to make by not attending the royal wedding. Cress hoped it would stay that way. She released a breath as the courtier returned the invitation to Wolf without a hint of hesitation.
"We are so pleased that you could join us after all, Bristol Darren," he said. "Please proceed to the ballroom, where you will be escorted to your seats."
By the time he finished, he was already reaching for the invitations of the couple behind them. Wolf guided her forward, and if he was sharing any of her anxiety, he didn't show it. The main corridor was lined with palace guards in fine red coats and tasseled epaulets. Cress recognized a painted screen on one wall, mountains standing over misty clouds and a crane-filled lake. Her gaze instinctively flitted up to one of the ornate chandeliers that lined the corridor. And, though it was too small for her to see, she knew that one of the queen's cameras was there, watching them, even now. Though she doubted the queen or Sybil or anyone who could possibly have recognized Cress was bothering to watch the surveillance feeds at that moment, she nevertheless turned her head away and started laughing as if Wolf had made a joke. He frowned at her.
"These chandeliers are extraordinary, aren't they?" she said, putting as much lightness into her tone as she could.
Wolf's expression remained unfazed, and after a blank moment, he shook his head and resumed his steady pace toward the ballroom. They found themselves on a landing that swooped down a grand staircase and opened up into an enormous, beautiful room. The mere size of it reminded her of the desert's expansiveness, and she was overwhelmed by the same awe and dizziness she'd had before. She was glad they weren't the only ones lingering at the top of the stairs and watching as the crowd drifted in and filled up rows of plush seats beneath them. There was at least an hour before the ceremony would officially begin, and many of the guests were using the time to mingle and take in the beauty of it all. Many pillars throughout the room were carved with gold-tinted dragons, and the walls were filled with so many bouquets of flowers, some as tall as cress, that it was like the gardens had begun to grow wild inside. Half a dozen birdcages stood beside the floor-to-ceiling windows, displaying doves and mockingbirds and sparrows, which sang a chaotic melody that rivaled the beauty of the orchestra. Cress turned to face Wolf so that, should anyone look at them, it would seem as though they were in deep conversation. He bent his head toward her to complete the masquerade, though his focus was on the nearest guard.
"You don't suppose we should mingle, do you?"
He screwed up his nose.
"I think we'd better not."
Glancing around, he held his elbow toward her.
"But perhaps we could go sympathize with some caged birds."
Chapter 48. After passing through the dank cellar, Cinder was glad to discover the escape tunnel was, well, fit for an emperor. The floor was tiled and the walls were smooth concrete, with dim light bulbs set every 20 steps. They could walk without fear of Thorn tripping on jagged rocks. Nevertheless, they were making painfully slow progress, and more than once Cinder considered leaving them behind. Thorn did a decent job of keeping up, but Dr. Erlon's age, combined with his short legs, made his pace feel like an agonizing crawl. If she didn't think it would offend him, she would have offered him a piggyback ride. She kept reminding herself that they had planned for this. They were right on schedule. It would all be fine. She told herself again and again. Eventually, she began to notice signs that they were approaching the palace. Stockrooms filled with non-perishable goods and jugs of water and rice wine. Power generators that sat silent and unused. Large rooms empty but for enormous round tables and uncomfortable-looking chairs, black net screens and switch panels and processors. Not state-of-the-art, but new enough that it was clear these escape tunnels would be ready for use if they were ever needed. Should the royal family ever need to go into hiding, they would be able to stay down here for a long time. And not just the royal family, Cinder realized as they trudged on, passing more stockrooms and hallways that branched in every direction. This was a labyrinth. It seemed that there was enough space for the entire government to come live down here, or at least everyone who worked in the palace. "We're almost there," she said, tracking their position through satellite navigation and the map on her retina display.
"Wait, where are we going again? It's been so long since we left the ship, I can't remember."
"Very funny, Thorn." She glanced back. Thorn was walking with one palm on the wall, and Dr. Erland was using his cane. She wondered how long it had been since Thorn had given it to him, and how long it had been since the doctor's breathless wheezing had begun in earnest. She'd hardly noticed it, too preoccupied with the plan that filled up her head. Now, seeing beads of sweat on the doctor's brow, dripping down from the brim of his hat, she paused. "Are you all right?"
"Dreamy," he breathed, his head lowered. "Just holding on to a comet's tail. Stardust and sand dunes and why is it so blasted hot in here?"
Cinder rubbed the back of her neck.
"Right,
we made good time," she lied. "Maybe we should rest for a minute?" The doctor shook his head.
"No, my crescent moon is up there. We stick to the plan."
Thorn inched toward them, looking equally perplexed.
"Isn't it a full moon tonight?"
"Doctor, you're not having hallucinations, are you?" Dr. Erlon narrowed his blue eyes at her.
"Go, I'm right behind. I'm better already."
Part of her wanted to argue, but she couldn't deny that there wasn't a whole lot of time to waste, even if he wanted to.
"Fine. Thorn?"
He shrugged and swung his hand toward her.
Lead the way.
Cinder double-checked the map and moved forward, waiting for one of the corridor offshoots to line up with the instructions Cress had given her. When she spotted a stairwell curling up out of view, she slowed down and checked their location with the palace blueprint.
I think this is it. Thorn, watch your step.
Doctor?
Heartly good, thank you, he said, gripping his side.
Bracing herself, Cinder started to climb. The stairs wrapped upward, the lights from below fading into shadows and, eventually, so much darkness that she turned on her flashlight again. The wall was smooth and undecorated but for a metal handrail. Cinder estimated that she'd trekked up 3 stories worth of steps before she came to a door. It was big enough for 4 people to walk through side by side, made of thick, reinforced steel. As expected, there were no hinges and no handle on this side. A failsafe in case anyone discovered the entrance into the safety tunnel and tried to sneak into the palace. This door was only meant to be opened from the inside. Gripping the handrail, Cinder raised her other fist and tapped out a melody. Then she waited, wondering if she'd been loud enough, wondering if they were too soon, wondering if they were too late and the plan had already fallen apart. But then she heard a noise, a thunking deadbolt, a grinding lock mechanism, the squeak of unused hinges. Aiko stood before her, beaming and holding a pile of neatly folded clothes.
Welcome to New Beijing Palace.
Though he didn't want to admit it out loud, Thorn was sad to be splitting up from Cinder and going forth with only the grumpy, wheezing doctor to act as his guide. So far, he hadn't sensed a whole lot of warmth coming off the old man, who didn't seem to think that fixing Thorn's blindness was a big priority, not to mention the crazy babble he'd been spouting down the tunnels. Nevertheless, here they were, in the palace, heading toward the labs where they would find the equipment necessary to do all the weird pseudoscience optical repair stuff the doctor had talked about. Alone. Just the two of them.
This way, said the doctor,
and Thorn adjusted his direction, keeping one hand on the wall. He missed the cane, but he could hear it clacking up ahead of him, and the doctor seemed to need it more. Thorn really, really hoped the doctor wasn't about to keel over. That would ruin oh so many things about this day.
See anybody? Thorn asked. Don't ask stupid questions.
Thorn scowled, but kept his mouth shut. It was as they'd hoped. No one would expect a palace break-in from the top-secret escape tunnels. So while all the guard power was being kept at the palace gates and around the ballroom, he and the doctor should have the lab wing all to themselves. At least, until it was time to draw some attention away from Cinder and Cress. The surface of the wall changed beneath his fingers, from a warm, papery texture to something cool and smooth. He heard a door open.
Here, said the doctor. More stairs.
Why not take the elevator?
It's android-operated, would require an authorized ID chip.
Thorn gripped the handrail and followed the doctor up. And up. The doctor had to stop twice to catch his breath, and Thorn waited, trying to be patient, all the while wondering what Cress was doing. If she would be ready when the time came. He didn't dwell on it. She was with Wolf. She would be fine. Finally, the doctor pushed open another door, a short distance across hard, slick floors, the new hum of lights overhead.
Cozy Lab 6D. This is where I met the princess, you know.
Lab 6D. Right. I've had good success meeting princesses in research labs myself. His nose wrinkled. The room smelled of hospitals. Sterile and cold and medicinal.
There's a lab table about 4 steps ahead of you. Lie down.
Really? You don't want to take a break, catch your breath?
We don't have time.
Gulping, Thorn inched forward until his hand smacked a padded table. He sought out the edge before lifting himself onto it. Tissue paper crinkled beneath him.
But isn't this the part where you shove sharp objects into my pelvic bone? Maybe we don't want to rush.
Are you nervous?
Yes, terribly so, yes.
The doctor snorted.
Just like you, to finally show a bit of humanity beneath the arrogance.
And of course, it's only a concern for yourself. I'm hardly surprised.
Wouldn't you be a little concerned in this situation? My eyesight, my pelvis,
my country, my princess, my daughter.
What daughter? What are you even talking about?
The doctor harrumphed, and Thorne could hear him banging through drawers.
I suppose your eyesight was lost while attempting to rescue Crescent from that satellite. For that alone, I suppose I do owe you.
Thorne scratched his cheek.
I suppose you do?
Did she tell you, by chance, how long she'd been imprisoned?
Cress?
7 years in the satellite.
7 years?
Yeah. Before that, I guess she was kept with a bunch of other shells in some volcanic dormitories or something.
I don't remember. That thaumaturge had been collecting blood samples from them, but Cress didn't seem to know why. A cabinet door slammed shut, followed by silence.
Doctor? Collecting blood samples? From shells.
Weird, right? But at least she wasn't subjected to any bizarre genetic tampering like Wolf. Thorne shook his head.
I'm not sure about those lunar scientists. They seem to be doing a lot of crazy stuff up there.
Another silence, before more rustling. Thorne heard a chair or a table being wheeled toward him.
They must have been using shell blood to develop the antidote, the doctor mused. But the timing doesn't make sense. She was taken before Letamosis even broke out here on Earth, before it was known to exist.
Thorne tilted his ear toward the doctor as his rambling faded off.
What now?
Unless,
what now?
Oh, stars. That's why they wanted them. The poor children. My poor sweet crescent moon.
Thorne settled his chin on his palm.
Never mind. You finish your nonsensical ramblings and let me know when you're ready to proceed.
Another rumble of wheels on the hard floor.
You do not deserve her, you know,
the doctor said, with a new edge to his tone.
I'm sure I... Wait. What?
I hope she comes to her senses soon, because I see how she looks at you, and I do not care for it, not one bit.
Who are we talking about?
Something clattered as the doctor dropped what Thorne assumed were medical tools onto a metal tray.
It doesn't matter now. Lie down.
Pause 1 second. And be honest. Thorne held up a finger. Are you having a mental breakdown right now?
The doctor huffed.
Carswell Thorne. I may have just made a very important discovery that must be shared with Emperor Kaito and the other Earthen leaders immediately. But that cannot happen until we have finished with this whole charade. Now, by my estimation, we have fewer than 5 minutes to extract the needed stem cells and divide them for the regeneration solution. I may not like you, but I am aware that we are on the same side, and we are both invested in seeing Cress and Cinder leave this palace today alive. Now, are you going to trust me or not?
Thorne considered the question for probably longer than the doctor wanted him to, before he sighed and lay back on the table.
Ready when you are. But first, don't forget to...
I haven't forgotten. Activating Letamosis outbreak alarm. Now.
Thorne heard the soft pad of fingertips on a net screen, and then a blaring siren screamed through the halls.